As we're hearing there on the WPR newscast, state Senate Republicans appear ready to reject Governor Evers' agriculture secretary designee with a vote today. We're talking about this development on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Brad Paff has led the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection since January. So what questions do you have about cabinet confirmations in our state? Do you support the Senate's firing ability? We're at 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is covering this as editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So a Friday, we heard from a spokesperson for Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald saying not enough votes to confirm the pick here of Governor Evers. How would they like the governor to respond?
Scott Fitzgerald, spokesman on Friday, indicated that he had asked the governor to withdraw the nomination rather than face the prospect of him being voted down. That would save them the vote. But the governor's office on Friday and again yesterday said they have no intention of doing that. Now, as we sit here just after 7 a.m., I was making calls the afternoon yesterday and checking with Fitzgerald's office last night. Senate Republicans will caucus this morning before going to the floor. So if the late last-minute lobbying effort had any success, we'll find out after they come out of that meeting sometime this morning.
Okay, so what happens, though, if he is not confirmed?
If he's not confirmed, Republicans changed state law back in December during the lame duck session to say if the Senate rejected a confirmation of a gubernatorial appointment, that person could not be resubmitted to the position. That means Brad Paff is basically done. Now, it doesn't mean he couldn't get a job in the administration somewhere else, but he could not be DACAP secretary anymore.
And then Governor Evers would need to make a new appointment.
Yes, and that's kind of one of the counterpoints I've heard from some people with the governor's administration and his supporters is that, you know, look, Brad Paff is a guy who grew up on a farm, who has a deep background in the agricultural industry, as a guy who cares about the issues. Evers, in their mind, chose him for a reason, that he's the best person that agree with their beliefs and could fill the role. So if you reject Brad Paff, what are you going to get instead? Some of the unhappiness Republicans seem to stem from a siting rule that's being proposed or considered by the agency over livestock facilities. That's still something being pushed by the administration or considered by the administration. If Brad's not there, it'd be somebody else in the same role filling the same mission from the governor about looking at this rule.
So
I'm not sure that would change.
Yeah, did the Senate always seem to oppose this nomination of Secretary Designee Paff, or did this opposition build up over time?
Brad cleared a Senate committee 9-0 back in February. There are five Republicans on that committee. I called all five of them yesterday. None of them called me back. But since then, a couple of things have happened. One, there was this controversy this summer over the release of money budgeted for grants to help farmers struggling with mental health issues. It was held up in being released. The Evers administration was criticizing Republicans about it, and Brad was quite vocal and quite critical of Republicans for not releasing this money, suggesting that they were kind of didn't care about the issue. Republicans took great offense to that. That was kind of the first big thing that we saw. Also, Joan Baldwig is a state representative from Markazin. She was leading a task force on suicide prevention from the assembly. There's a complaint from that task force that Brad was not turning over information that they requested. So those are the first kind of signs of trouble. But the siting rule, and what the siting rule would do would say, if you're a local government and you require permits for the expansion or the siting of a livestock facility, you'd have to meet certain requirements, such as setbacks from other residents, those kinds of things. This rule has been in progress for a couple of years now, at least. The progress kind of came to a head recently. That really irritated some Republicans as well, who felt like that rule was not paying attention to the challenges facing the ag industry right now, that it would hurt the agriculture industry, and they wanted to push back against it. And this seems to be one of the ways of doing that by going after Brad Paff.
We're talking with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. We're talking about the vote scheduled in the state Senate today to essentially fire Governor Evers' pick to lead the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, which is an unusual move. What do you think of it? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. J.R., take us back in time. Is the Senate essentially vetoing a governor's pick. Is this normal for how our government functions? You know, when has this happened in the past?
No. I've asked the Legislative Reference Bureau. They went back to 1987. They couldn't find an example of it. I asked the state, the Senate Chief Clerk's Office. Their records go back to the mid-90s. There was an example where a nominee to be the Transportation Secretary, his nomination was tabled, but wasn't rejected. So I have found no record so far of a cabinet pick being rejected. It's actually unusual we're this far into a governor's term with only five cabinet members picked, or sorry, confirmed by the Senate. But we're also in an unusual time. Go back to December with the lame duck session. It was one of the first shots fired in a very acrimonious relationship between the executive branch and legislative Republicans. That relationship has not improved since then. It's probably gotten worse, to be honest with you. So if you recall, those actions from the extraordinary session were held up by a couple of Dane County judges' rulings. During the window when they were held up, Governor Evers moved to rescind a number of appointments from Governor Walker and put his own people in place. That irritated Republicans. So they didn't want to confirm Governor Evers' cabinet pick, you know, in the middle of all that stuff going on, had the budget going, and so it got pushed back until now. So here we are in November. There are basically a third of his cabinet has been confirmed. I've been coming to the Capitol for almost 20 years. I've never seen this before. At the same time, the relationships in the Capitol have gotten about as bad as they've ever been, I think, in the time that I've been here. It's just a very much a partisan atmosphere, and each side keeps pointing fingers about who's to blame for it being so partisan.
Let's bring in Nate now in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me. The more I hear about this, the more it sounds very much that this is somebody who they're basically trying to fire over politics, not over how good of a job he's doing. He sounds like he's probably doing just fine. And on top of that, I wonder if one day this could lead to another court case over the lame duck laws, because this is potentially interfering with the executive branch and its ability to do its responsibilities by having people who would carry those responsibilities out. If there's anything that ought to be questioned at this point, I think if it's the ability of the legislature to really do this, because it seems unnecessarily, and it's not just partisan, but detrimental to the state.
Yeah, Nate, I'm gonna field this back to JR as we're short on time here. Is this partisan politics at work?
Oh, sure. There are politics at play at everything in the Capitol. I mean, that's always going on. It's interesting with this, you know, if you think about, you know, I've been new to a job before, and I had like a 90-day probationary period or whatever, you know, you have some positions. This has been Brad Foss' probationary period. Some people I talked to yesterday said, look, here's a guy who's on probation, essentially, and he went out and went out of his way to antagonize Republicans who had the authority to fire him. That wasn't the best move on his part back in the summer. So maybe it's partisan, but there are things that Brad could have done differently that maybe would avoid getting the situation. What I want to know going forward is what this means for the Capitol and relations. They keep getting worse between Governor Evers and GOP leaders. I don't know that this would improve things. What I'm watching today is there was this last-minute lobbying effort by Administration Secretary Joel Brennan, Tammy Baldwin, Ron Kind, all these ag groups saying, hey, at the very least, put off a vote on Brad. Let's talk about this some more. Will that work? That's his best hope right now, is maybe a delay in a vote.
JR, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Anytime.
J.R. Ross is editor of WispPolitics.com. Coming up, we discuss the challenges Indigenous scholars face in research institutions and academia. Stay with us, back in a moment for more conversation here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about how schools can better partner with tribal communities and help advance Indigenous research and knowledge. Northwestern University professor Patty Lowe cites this one statistic that sticks with me. It's estimated that over the next couple decades, 90% of our world's Indigenous languages will be dormant. Are you a Native scholar or faculty member? What's your experience been like in academia? What questions do you have about the challenges Indigenous people face in university settings? We're at 800-642-1234. Patty Lowe is an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. She's a professor at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism, inaugural director of its Center for Native American and Indigenous Research, and her most recent book is called Seventh Generation Earth Ethics, Native Voices of Wisconsin. She was recently inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Patty, welcome back to the Ideas Network, and congratulations on being inducted into the Academy.
Thank you so much, Kate. My heart has been, it's always been in Wisconsin, and so it's just a real pleasure to join you this morning.
Rates of access to higher education for Indigenous students, they fare quite a bit lower than the U.S. Mm-hmm. population and that of other groups. What's right. going on there?
Well, I think there's a combination of factors. I think the last statistics I saw, which are probably 6 or 7 years old, is that 0.3%, 0.3% of Native people go on to get doctorates. I think each year there may be 8,000 or 9,000 doctorates that are awarded. And the last statistics I saw, 13 of those went to Native students. So obviously there's something wrong. I think that it's difficult when Native people decide to go into higher education and pursue a doctorate. And maybe I'm projecting a little bit, but I think this is true. A disproportionate number of them really want to study something or research an issue that will ultimately help their communities. And so their orientation is on applied theory or applied research. And I'm not so sure that that's valued as much as publishing and conference presentations and some of the other things that are valued at the doctoral level at universities. And what happens is a Native student has to leave his or her, their community, and those connections with their communities are broken. And the definition of success in Indian country, I think, is different, just a different definition than it is in mainstream society. In our communities, you're successful if you're part of a community, if you're helping elders, if you're teaching children, if you're doing service. That's not exactly what a successful academician looks like at the university level.
In that whole tenure process and in the academy, Patty, what does applied research look like to you and some of that service element that you see among Native people in academia?
Well, I can use one of my own projects. For the last 15 years, I've been working with tribal teens on reservations in northern Wisconsin, most recently my own, where I teach 14 to 17-year-olds how to use professional video cameras and compose digital music and do photojournalism. And we have a need in our communities for traditional ecological knowledge and science. So what I do is I go to communities in the spring and say, what do you want your kids to know? And then I use what I do best, teaching how to use these cameras and digital equipment, and turn what I do toward the need that's been identified by the community. And so the last couple of years at Bad River, we've been collecting traditional ecological knowledge and creating an archive for Bad River. That's something that's considered outreach and service, but for me, I look at that as research and teaching. Mm-hmm. And the best kind of learning, from my perspective, is learning that incorporates research, teaching, service, and outreach. And that integrated approach to learning is not something that is often, I think you see it at universities, but it's not a pillar of what scholars are supposed to do.
We're talking with Patty Lowe, who's a journalism professor at Northwestern. She heads up its Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. You can join in. What questions do you have about challenges that Native people face in higher education? How do you think universities could be better partners to tribal communities? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I was struck, Patty, that you said when you went to Northwestern, when you went to Chicago, that you were really focused on listening and developing relationships, and that Native people there told you that they're invisible, that there are no federally recognized tribes in Illinois, there's no curriculum in the schools like here in Wisconsin, that we have Act 31, an education mandate. What are you finding in Chicago and how it contrasts to education that you've explored in Wisconsin schools?
Well, there are, and before I answer that, can I go back to something that I think you said that was really important? You know, you asked when you introduced me again, what can universities do to create a better environment for Native students? What can universities do? I think that's really important because for years, we asked the wrong question. We asked, you know, how do we prepare Native students to be successful at universities? What do they have to do in order to meet our standards of success? And I think we're understanding now that we have to ask ourselves, what do we have to do? How do we change our structures at the university to make it more welcoming to students of color? And I think that's really important, and I didn't want to let that go uncommented upon.
Sure, absolutely.
So here at Northwestern, there was a fair degree of understanding about how little we offered in the way of Native courses and support for Native students. And that changed about 5 years ago when students demanded that things change. It was the 150th anniversary of the Sand Creek Massacre, and our founder, John Evans, had played a major role in that and, in fact, was stripped of his governorship because of that role. There was this sort of collective amnesia about that on the part of university officials. And because of these student demands, there was a major investigation, historical investigation, and a steering committee. And there were 50-some recommendations that came out of that, including the establishment of a Native American research center, a minor in Native studies, more Native classes, an emphasis on recruiting and retaining Native students. So there was this whole, a major change in the way Northwestern approached Native American studies and research. And so the level of understanding and awareness was very high at Northwestern. And since I've arrived and since other faculty have arrived to meet the mandates of this John Evans Steering Committee, we've been talking to other academics in the Chicago area at the University of Illinois Chicago, at the University of Chicago, Loyola and DePaul, and we're really committed to addressing this invisibility. One of the things that I did was I created, with the help of my students, an indigenous tour of Northwestern. So I turned my media history class toward researching where Native people history events, initiatives intersected with places on campus. They researched them, they created media, and now we have this two versions of a tour. One is a story map and the other is a GPS guided walking tour. So it was a service to the community. It involved teaching and learning outreach and service because it can be used as a recruitment tool. And we're creating curriculum for Evanston schools so that they can learn more about the Indigenous past of our area. So that's what I mean when I say, to me, teaching, research, outreach, service is all part of the same jewel. It's just a different facet. I mean, there are different facets to that jewel.
We're talking with Northwestern University journalism professor Patty Lowe about the work she does to help advance research and scholarship about Native nations. Does your school have a relationship with the tribal community in your area? What did you learn about the Native community in your area during your academic experience? Join in 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're exploring how schools can become better partners with tribal communities, how to advance scholarly research and knowledge, building more trust, building more understanding with tribal communities. Northwestern University Professor Patty Lowe thinks about this a lot. She works closely with Native youth, teaching digital storytelling skills, as she spoke to us earlier about. Did you pursue a bachelor's or graduate degree? Do you remember having an Indigenous professor or Native teaching assistant? What questions do you have about challenges Indigenous people face in academia? Join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Patty Lowe stays with us. She's co-director of Northwestern's Center for Native American and Indigenous Research, and she was recently inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Patty, Indigenous languages are fading away. You're documenting this. You are, you know, talking with tribal citizens, with microphones, with recording equipment. How do research institutions like universities affect Native communities?
Well, I think they can affect them in very positive ways by listening to them, listening to what is important to a particular community, and there are 573 federally recognized Indian nations, so, you know, the needs change from one community to the next. But allowing, encouraging, not just allowing, but encouraging those Native communities to determine their own research, what they want to know, and then using the resources of a university partner to help get them there, rather than the university saying, oh, I'm interested, here's the group of researchers who are interested in epidemiology, and look at, there's $1 million federal grant to study diabetes, quick, let's, you know, find a Native community to partner with. And, you know, the parameters of the grant, the approach, the methodology, everything is already set so that the, you know, the tribal community is really just an afterthought. Those kinds of research partnerships don't work. We know that. The community feels disrespected and undervalued and just a cash cow for university researchers. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we, Native academics are trying to change in universities.
You interviewed a Potawatomi tribal citizen who told you the story of the tribe's removal from their lands after the Treaty of Chicago, and he spoke in Potawatomi and then translated the story in English. How important was that moment?
You know, that individual, Nelson Chepo, became kind of an adopted grandfather to me, and he was a really important person in my life. In the 1980s, I interviewed him, and he told the story of the Prairie Band of Potawatomi removal after the Treaty of Chicago in 1833, and he told it in Potawatomi, and then he would immediately translate himself to English. I recognized, I was working for the ABC affiliate in Madison at the time. I recognized the significance of that interview and gave it to the Wisconsin Historical Society to preserve. I would have given it to the Potawatomi, but there wasn't, you know, there this was before gaming, and there weren't any research facilities or museums at that time. So the Wisconsin Historical Society preserved it, and then when I was creating this indigenous tour of Northwestern, I asked if they would digitize it and send it back, and they did. What was really gratifying for me is in the grant that I received to create this tour, I asked for money to hire Potawatomi language speakers at Pekagan, which is our closest Potawatomi band. They're in southwestern Michigan, just over the border, kind of in the almost in the Chicago metro area. And so they provided speakers, which helped create the soundscape for the tour, and then I was able to use some grant money to make a donation to their language program, and the Wisconsin Historical Society was willing to let me share that video with the Pekagan Band Potawatomi's language department. So those are the kinds of connections that I'm always trying to look for, something that combines, again, teaching, research, outreach, service.
Yeah, and certainly I'm sure that that tape will be cherished for generations.
Absolutely. You know, Pokagon is down, I think Kyle Malott, who's the language director there, told me that Pokagon is down to 6 first speakers. So they're trying to revitalize their language, and this is happening all over the country. I know the Menominee are down to just a handful of first speakers as well, and Native communities are trying everything to try to revitalize their languages. I don't want to say the languages are, you know, will go extinct because we now have the technology to record them and preserve them, but if no one's speaking them, then they're dormant, and that is, it's just, I can't even begin to think how devastating that will be, because so much of the culture is embedded in the language.
As I think about your applied research, you take students to the Oneida's white corn harvest in the fall,
right.
And it's really hands-on. It's, you know, the work of harvesting and shucking and braiding corn with the Oneida. Why do you do that?
Because I think experiential learning, at least for me, I think I had a short but intense attention span, they told me when I was a kid. I like being someplace and be situational kind of learning. And a lot of the students in my Native American environmental issues in the media class have never been to a farm. It was surprising. About 60-70% of them had never been to a farm. And I was trying to teach about food sovereignty and how Native communities are trying to reclaim their traditional foods. So the Oneida White Corn Cooperative has this amazing couple of weekends where they are trying to process, hand process, an extraordinary amount of corn. They need help. And so by taking, you know, 20 students up to Oneida, having 20 extra sets of hands, a lot of it is just busy work where you're sitting around and shucking corn. And the Oneida are telling stories. My students are learning. But they're also helping this community with a lot of busy work that would take the Oneida much, much longer. It's really an extraordinary learning opportunity, and I've just read and graded the essays that students wrote about it, and it's it made me more convinced that this is the right way to help my students learn, is to create these opportunities.
We're talking with Patty Lowe. She's a professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern, and we're talking about the pathway for Native students at four-year institutions, how universities can build more trust and further knowledge with Native communities. Did you go to college or plan to work in academia? What was your experience like? And what is the experience like in tribal communities in your area? How do they interface with schools, with universities? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Patty, let's look at inside departments now. As you talk with Native professors, and you've made a lot of relationships, done a lot of relationship building across Northwestern, what do Native professors tell you about their own research and about how they fit into the university structure?
Well, I won't talk specifically about Northwestern professors, but I will say in general what I hear, you know, I belong to groups like the National Indian Education Association and National Association of Native American Scholars, so I talk to a lot of Native professors. And what I hear over and over again is that they're just overextended, and they want to make a difference in their communities. And so most Native studies are programs, not departments. And the difference is a department can grant tenure, a program can't. So a program has to partner, find a willing department, and then bring in a Native scholar that's mutually acceptable to both the department and the program. So that Native scholar has to make a decision. Does she serve the department, which wants her to publish and do conference presentations and, you know, is steep herself in academia, or does she, you know, should she be true to what got her to the university in the first place, this desire to help your community, which means service and outreach and those things that aren't valued. And what happens is either the Native scholar serves the department, maybe loses the connections that she has at her, in her community, and disappoints her community members and gets tenure, or she does applied research, continues with those relationships in the community and doesn't get tenure, or tries to do both, and there's a tremendous burnout rate. So let's say that individual now has tenure, and they're at a university, and they're probably the only Native scholar in their department, maybe in their college, maybe the only one, or maybe one of just a few in their whole university. I mean, that was my experience when I got to Northwestern. What happens then is that that person winds up being the Native appointment to every committee you can imagine, and the demands for academic service are just tremendous. And it's one thing if you're a full professor like I am, where I don't have to worry about tenure, but if you're an assistant professor working toward tenure, this is just another drain on your time and takes you away from the research that you're going to need to do and publish in order to get tenure.
We're talking with Northwestern University Professor Patty Lowe. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Indigenous research and where we go from here. It's a conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're with Northwestern University Professor Patty Lowe, who recently completed an interactive online tour of the University Northwestern that explores the Native American history of the shores along Lake Michigan. And it explores who was here before the colonists and what their life was like. It's one of the research jumping off points this hour. You can join in 800-642-1234. And Patty Lowe is with the Medill School of Journalism. She stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Alice is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Patty, I graduated from Nace College in Chicago with a BA in Native American Studies, and one of the things I really wanted to do is work with a tribe. And every time I went for any interview, I always got the same kind of answer, which was they told me that I needed to have at least a quarter amount of Native American blood in me, for requirement of a certain position. And I was wondering, I always felt that wasn't right.
Huh. You know, that's I think it's not universal because my tribe, for example, does lineal descendancy. We don't do blood quantum, and there are plenty of tribes that don't, the Cherokee, for example, and there are other tribes. So I think that is just a situational kind of thing and not something that is universal.
Alice, thanks for the call. Melody now in Manitowash. Hi, Melody.
Hi.
Hi, Melody.
Hi, thank you for having this talk. We need to have one every month. I am from the East Coast, and I am really blessed with going to Northland College and learning about Native American studies. I took Native American arts and crafts. And through my college in Wisconsin, I learned about my Native communities in New York. So there's a definitely huge lack of education nationwide and appreciation of the positive contributions historically and present day of our Native American communities.
I couldn't agree with you more, Melody. And I think now as we're facing all these, really substantial challenges with climate and changing landscapes, you know, I think we can learn from people that have had a relationship with their land for thousands of years.
Melody, it sounds like you were really changed by having this access to this type of education.
Oh, yeah. It had completely changed my course of my life. Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for the call. Patty, as you talk about the lands, you are also exploring Standing Rock and what that meant to the reservation. We recently had a conversation here about Standing Rock. What are you exploring?
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in the solidarity movement that came out of that that struggle, and how Native people and Indigenous people all over the world are connecting around that that notion of the need to protect water. And no matter where you go, that's a relevant question in every single Indigenous community that I've ever spent time in, is how do we protect the water? And I think as we move into really uncertain times with climate and changing landscapes and, mobility of people, I think that's a really fundamental question to keep in mind.
So going forward with land-grant universities, with institutions, how do we make them a place that Indigenous communities trust, that they become better partners, these universities?
That is such a great question, and I've been thinking more and more about solutions kind of journalism. So what do we have to do to change it? I think universities have to take a really good, long, hard look and ask the question, am I willing to make, or are we willing to make, fundamental changes? It's not enough to just say, oh, I'm open to hiring Native people and start counting, red faces and black faces and yellow faces and brown faces. It's not about color. It's about worldview. And so I think universities have to come up with a different definition of success if they truly want to be diverse and include Native people in their academic community. They have to understand that a Native scholar is more likely to bring this commitment to applied research and practical application of research in Native communities.
Patty, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Patty Lowe is a professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. We've been talking about Indigenous scholars at research institutions. You'll find the full conversation later today at WPR.org or stream it on Wisconsin Public Radio's mobile app. Stories of violent crime make headlines, but for survivors, those moments of trauma can have lasting effects. Corrine Hess reports on how Frederick Hospital has spent the last decade working with its patients to rebuild their lives after trauma.
Michelle Real was conscious throughout her attack.
He came back downstairs and he said, "I see you're still trying to hold on. Go on and die."
Real was in the basement using the washing machine when her boyfriend came up behind her and strangled her. He then slit her throat.
I could grab a pillow and die comfortably on the basement floor. I could run and perhaps get caught again as he was in the house. Or I could run and be safe.
She ran to a neighbor's house and was awake in the ambulance while paramedics prepped her about what would happen in Frederick's emergency room. For months, even after Real went back to work as a special education teacher, she couldn't hear the sound of sirens without having a panic attack.
I actually literally would stutter, my heart would beat fast, and this could be at any environment. I could be working in my classroom and hear a siren and just have to take deep breaths and remind myself.
Frederick therapists suggest she relive the event by touring an ambulance.
I think reliving the situation was very helpful, and I think that's how I was able to process as well as I have been able to.
Terry Darun Cassini is a clinical psychologist and medical director for Frederick's trauma psychology program. Frederick was one of the first hospitals in the country that screens trauma patients for PTSD symptoms. The program started about 11 years ago, when clinicians realized patients didn't automatically begin healing when the surgeons finished with them.
They all share this experience where kind of out of the blue, unexpectedly, something very intense and sometimes life-threatening can happen to them. And sometimes there is distress that follows.
The man who tried to kill Real was charged with first-degree intentional homicide and sentenced to 43 years in prison. Real saw Darun Cassini weekly after her attack, and then monthly. The hospital still has her case open, in case she wants to start dating again. But she's not ready for that.
I always find excuses not to. Oh, they're really nice, but...
Real has put that part of her life on hold. She left Milwaukee to be closer to her dad in Appleton. Cleaning up her classroom on a recent afternoon, she says her three young children are thriving, and she's happy.
I am very fortunate that I still have a positive attitude, that I could overcome things, that I could forgive, but a lot of it was in therapy, talking through things, reliving things.
Frederick treats about 5,000 trauma patients a year. Darun Cassini's team sees about 40% of those patients. Darun Cassini says sometimes cases are even more complicated than Real's. Suspects aren't caught. Victims have to go home to unsafe situations.
Especially if you consider somebody who might have been shot in their neighborhood or in their home even, and then thinking about their own safety issues when they're returning home. And so there's another element that's involved in their recovery beyond purely the symptoms they're experiencing, but also restoring a sense of safety.
Reggie Moore heads the city's Office of Violence Prevention. He says violence does not only affect an individual who was harmed, but the entire community.
In many cases, violence can shake it to the core, the sense of safety and the sense of normalcy that a community could have. And under no circumstances should violence ever become the norm.
The idea is to treat violence as a public health problem, before it happens and after. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And just ahead, a political scientist joins us to discuss the latest news on the House impeachment inquiry against President Trump. Then we explore the state of public transportation in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.